Chapter 6 of Greengrey Homestead by Steele Rudd. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Read by Anna Simon. It'll be a damp, drizzling day, a day when homesteaders turn their hands to plaiting greenhide into rope and reins, or to ring-barking. And you, with the help of Watty Nutt, who, in passing, has taken refuge at the back of the old shed from a sharp shower, will be sharpening your axe on the grindstone. For you'll have a notion of doing a bit of ringing in one of the gorges where the grass always seems to be sour. And as Watty turns the grindstone and you hold the axe, you'll both talk between jolts and grunts and stoppages about scrubs and timber. "There isn't much of the good stuff left now, Dick," Watty will lament. "Most of the rosewood and blackbutt and oak has pretty well disappeared from these parts altogether. There's a fair amount of silky oak left in the ranges, but it's so darn hard to get at that it takes more than it's worth to cut and haul." "That's so, Watty," you'll grunt in agreement, for he'll be tugging and jerking your rickety grindstone in such a way to speed it up that you'll require your two eyes and two hands to hold the axe in position and save your fingers from being amputated. "And as for the cedar, though my old man used to reckon that it once was as plentiful around here as ironbark and box, you never see a tree standing now." "Never seen a cedar sapling in my life that I can remember, unless on a precipice in some of those mountain hollows, where a beggaring goat could hardly keep its feet, to say nothing of a man with a team of bullocks." "Strange thing, that, Watty." He'll snatch the implement from the creaking, jolting grindstone. Taken unawares, Watty will put in several rapid revolutions of waste energy. "I've noticed it, too." You'll pass your thumb over the edge of the axe to test it. "And never by any chance do you see any of the old stumps about, either." "What did they do with it all?" Watty will wonder. "There was no market much for it then." "Knocked it all down and burned it up to clear their holdings and fulfil conditions, I suppose," you'll muse, taking up a billy of water and pouring some of the contents over the face of the axe and over the grindstone. "But lots of the old homes, even cowsheds and lofts and gate-posts, still standing, have the best cedar in them." And you cautiously apply the axe to the grindstone again, at the same time warning Watty to turn a bit slower this time. His thoughts will be carried back to boyhood, and, lifting his voice above the rocking, clock-clocking of the whirling, grating grindstone, will reveal a philosophic side to his nature. "I can remember old man McGarry sawing down the last of the big cypress pines that grew near his place under the MacPherson ranges," he'll tell you almost sadly. "I was only a kid then, but I felt that the old man and the fellow he had helping him were murderers." You'll risk taking your eyes from the wobbling grindstone to cast a glance of understanding at Watty. His eyes, though, won't meet yours. They'll be fixed on the ground, and he'll be absorbed in reflection as he turns the handle. Changing his mind, he'll continue, "And I'll never forget my feelings, Dick, when staring up at that lonely, lofty, silent tree, standing there before it fell. It had become a link in the lives of us boys when hunting the bush for bears and birds' nests. To us that old tree was a monarch, the king of trees in the ranges, and some mighty big box and ironbark grew about the MacPherson then, Dick. Wonder it didn't die of loneliness when it was the only one left standing," you'll jerk out, "for a tree will fret itself to death, you know." "It didn't, Dick. And though maggies were always warbling and yabbering amongst its green boughs in summer-time, and parrots screaming, we never thought of pelting them there." You'll flash another glance of understanding at Watty as you make a non-stop change to turn the blade of the axe. "And gad, Dick, as a darned old cross-cut seesawed and seesawed at its trunk, I felt it was myself it was going through, and so acutely that I was on the verge of running away so as not to be in sight when it fell, for I trembled at the thought of hearing it fall, and of seeing it down and dying with its old green cloak around it. And then, though I didn't know why, just as it gave the first crack, I ran in shouting to them to stop, not to cut that old tree down, and tucked at old McGarry's dangling shirt-tail." You'll suddenly lift the axe from the grindstone again to grin curiously at Watty. "I've had that feeling too, Watty," you'll tell him. "But what a risky thing you did, running in when the darn tree was starting to crack." "Wasn't it?" he'll admit. "But if you'd heard those old bandbacks yelling to me to run to hell from here, it's going to fall, and had seen how, when the tree gave several cracks, they abandoned the saw and ran for safety themselves, you'd have had your feelings changed as I had mine. Instead of protesting, you'd have thrown yourself down in the long grass and laughed." "I can see it all," you'll smile, passing your thumb over the edge of the axe-blade again. "But I suppose the old vandals made no use of the tree, just left it to the weather or the first bushfire." "I suppose so, Dick," he'll agree, wistfully. "But I could have cried when I heard the crash, and saw the old monarch down full length on the earth, never to rise again. For there it lay when I ran back, filled with the kid's idea of doing something to save it, its limbs broken and crushed, and the sap oozing from its wounds like blood from one of us." "I know, Watty, I know." And you'll take a seat on the ground with your back against the wall of the old shed, and the axe across your knees. "I've seen it all, and felt the same as you." "And what seemed strange to me," he'll continue, "was how soon the sun started to ravage it in its helplessness, just like a wild animal devouring its crippled prey. For almost immediately the fresh green foliage began to droop and curl, and the song that had crooned to the winds, even when the cross-cut was severing its vitals, was silenced. And, on my soul, Dick, you couldn't imagine how I hated those old fellows as I hung over the stump." "I can, Watty," you will affirm. "The same sort of pity came to me, Dick, that fellows often feel when they stand over a bullock they've just peathed or bulleted in a killing-yard, and put their hands on its still warm body. Even though the brute had done its best to put its horn through them, they feel a bit sorry for having ended its life." "I felt it, Watty," you'll admit, reflectively. Then, as he rakes away the loose earth to shape a place to sit opposite you, you'll ask, "Did you ever look down upon a scrub of cypress pine from the top of a high mountain?" "Lots of times, Dick, and never wanted to take my eyes off it." "What a sight it is, you remember. No other timber that I know of makes such a picture. Though crowded together, the tops of the trees seem set evenly, all pointing skyward like church spires, and tumbling away for miles in massed squares and triangles. And when you're down amongst them, Dick, the masses of ferny branches hang round the trunks like cloaks, but what clinging things they are to gallop through." "Gad, don't I know," thoughtfully from you. "Of course you saw a lot of it one time, Dick," and a glow of admiration in his face will stir your memory. "On Western Creek, you'll recall, along with Jim Houston and Jack Fitz." "Great horsemen, the pair of them, Dick." "I hunted wild cattle with them in the pine scrubs out there," you'll tell him. "And what scrubs they were! They had been at it for years, and how they knew the lay of the country, those two fellows, and every move of the wild mobs. But the game was new to me. Though you could ride like hell in the ranges and sit bucks with your pipe in your mouth, you soon found you had a lot to learn in the pines." "It makes a new chum of you, doesn't it?" from him. "It did of me, Watty, for I blundered behind Houston and Fitz for a whole week, often losing sight of them altogether, and hardly ever seeing a sign of the mob we were after." "And you one of the best horsemen on the ranges then, Dick." "Till one day, Watty, we struck the biggest, wildest, and swiftest mob ever met out there, and yarded over 100 of them." "You did!" in astonishment from Watty. "I had a good mount that day, a black horse called Trooper, 3 parts thoroughbred, by Leopold, fast and handy, a horse I gave an old stockman who was quitting the game 10 pounds for, and he'd had a couple of weeks' spell." "I know the sort, Dick." "It was about midday, and the mob was camping well out from the pine scrub when we came on them. A curious thing, too, Watty, that Fitz, as we rode quietly along, had just said what a find it would be if we started a mob there. And no sooner were the words out of his mouth when, gad, there in front of us were 500, if there was a hoof, covering 3 or 4 acres of ground, most of them lying down, the rest standing in the shade of scattered coolibah trees, chewing the cud and flicking the flies off with their tails." "Wars, what luck!" Watty will gasp. "Luck? We could hardly believe they were scrub cattle at all, just for the moment. Hell, look out, chaps!" I remember Houston calling, Then in an instant all that were lying were on their feet, and the whole mob, with an affrighted snort that stirred the air, jumped into their stride, tails up over their backs, and thundered off. In open order, in massed formation, in line, but all following the lead of two bulls, a black and a red, they made for the pine scrub a quarter of a mile away. "Stick to them, chaps, one of you on each side!" Fitz shouted. I can almost hear him now, as we wrapped our heels into our horses and grabbed a short grip of the reins. "I'll follow them up." What a race it was! But we never caught sight of each other again until it was all over. "Ghost! I see them going, Dick, with you fellows after them," Watty will chuckle excitedly. "They cut the pace too, Watty," you'll continue, reaching the pines almost abreast of each other. I flashed level with the end ones. A young bull and a white cow were nearest me, I remember, just as we hit the thick of it. But Trooper, with eyes set, had chosen his path. I crouched on his neck, dropped him the reins, and into the cypress we dashed and swished. There were no thorns and entanglements, but how dense and dark it all was! Had I time to think, I must have thought that scrub was filled with spirits of darkness. But I clung with my heels as I crouched, my head tucked under, leaving the pace and the course to Trooper. And how he tore and swept me as part of himself through those clustering pines! "Holy! I can see the two of you, Dick!" The going was soft, though, and level as a table, Watty. There wasn't a stone or a gully, but the swishing and tearing of the mob was like the roaring of the sea, and I kept in touch with the mob by ear. Suddenly there came brief flashes of light, and into the narrow open space we raced. Trooper crossed it like crossing a lane, and as I lifted my head I saw the white cow on my left and let out a whoop of triumph for the others to hear. Then into more pines and dimness again. But that narrow break was only the first of others much wider to follow. They came in rapid succession until right out in the open we burst, scrubbers and horsemen together. Gad, Watty, if I live to be 100, I shall never forget the riding and shouting and charging that followed. "You yard a lot of them, though, Dick," and Watty'll rise excitedly. "But they broke through the yard in the night, old chap, and got back to the cypress again," you'll answer. End of chapter 6.